This program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL, AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you on Easter Sunday. We have a very special show for you today. A terrific guest, someone who's been on the program before, and I'm delighted to welcome her back. Amy Goodman, the internationally acclaimed journalist and host of Pacifica Network's Democracy Now! Amy Goodman is also the author of a new book, The Exception to the Rulers, which she wrote with David Goodman, her brother, also a well-known journalist. And Amy Goodman is going to be in Urbana-Champaign on Friday, April 23rd. She will be giving a benefit for WEFT Community Radio at the Illinois Disciples Foundation, April 23rd at 6:15. And she will be appearing on Media Geek, Paul Rismandel's show on WEFT at 5:30 on Friday, April 23rd. So please mark that down on your calendars. And today, sit back and listen and enjoy our conversation with Amy Goodman. Let me let you know that we are taping this show a few days before going on air, so please don't call in today. Just sit back, relax, and let Amy and me do all the blathering. Amy, welcome to Media Matters.
It's great to be with you, Bob.
Yeah, and it's always a pleasure to have you. You know, we've talked about this before when you've been on the show. The caliber of journalism you do, I think, really goes to the heart of what type of journalism a democratic society needs to be successful. And much of your work, as in the subtitle of your new book, The Exception to the Rulers, which is exposing oily politicians, war profiteers, and the media that love them, much of your work really stands in contrast to sort of the mainstream media. I mean, that's really, I think, the defining feature in a way is how different you are from the preponderance of the mainstream press in this country, both commercial and public. And in the book, early on, you talk about what you call the deafening silence of the news media on a whole range of issues. What is the deafening silence? And give some examples of the sort of issues that aren't getting covered that ought to be covered in our news media.
Well, I use the word silence in lots of ways. For example, I say that the voices that aren't being heard are not just the voices of fringe minority or a silent majority, but the silenced majority, silenced by the mainstream media. And I shouldn't even use the term mainstream. I should say silenced by the corporate media, because it is not representing the mainstream of people in this country. You look at events leading up to the invasion of Iraq, the two weeks around General Colin Powell making his speech at the UN, his push for war. This was leading up to that February 5th speech. The week before and after, FAIR did a study on that evening newscasts of the four most important newscasts, ABC, NBC, CBS, and PBS, you had 393 interviews done around the issues of war. Only three were with representatives of anti-war organizations, three of almost 400, when you had at least half the people in this country opposed to war. That is simply a media beating the drums for war and silencing everyone else. Now, I could think of a very good example of a story today that has gotten almost no coverage, and that is what happened in Haiti on February 28th and 29th, the ouster of the democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. This is a story that I wish was not a Democracy Now! Global exclusive. It's an unbelievable story.
You're not trying to monopolize the market.
That's right. Yeah. We are, in fact, our motto is steal this story, please. But on the February 28th and 29th, this was at a time when Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who was elected, by the way, with a higher percentage of the vote in Haiti than President Bush was here in this country. He describes a remarkable story. And at the time, at the end of February, we interviewed his wife, Mildred Aristide, who is an attorney, a Haitian American in the palace. And she said that while the U.S. was putting tremendous pressure, they were not leaving the country. And within days, we were not able to contact them anymore. No one was, even their closest friends. And we learned from Friday to Monday, that the Aristides were in the Central African Republic. They had been dumped there in a remote area of Africa. How did this happen? Well, first of all, in the days leading up to this, there were these so-called rebels who were moving in supposedly on the Capitol. And the U.S. was there busily at the time. We're trying to find out what they're doing. Who are these people? Where did the why didn't the media tell us who they were? People like Jodel Chamblain, not hard to figure out who he was. He was the number two man in FRAP. He had been found guilty in absentia of the murder of the justice minister 10 years ago. Guy Mallory found guilty of the murder of Antoine Ismery, a well-known Haitian businessman, in 1993. In fact, September 11th, 93. They have had their own September 11th. And he was murdered on that day by the paramilitary death squads because it was the fifth anniversary of a massacre that took place on yet another September 11th, 1988, when Aristide, then a priest, was speaking to his congregation and thugs moved in and massacred the people. The coup of 91 to 94 was supported by the U.S. government with the leader of the paramilitary death squad, Emmanuel Constant, on the payroll of the CIA and the DIA, the Pentagon's CIA. This was exposed by investigative journalist Alan Nairn. That was 10 years ago. And now we move to today, and the same players are back. Jodel Chamblain of FRAP, convicted murderer. Jean Tatoum, convicted of the massacre of Aristide supporters in 94. At Rabateau. He leads the uprising. These are who these people are. Is the media telling us who these people are, as opposed to saying opposition forces that Jean-Bertrand Aristide should negotiate with? It's truly astounding, because what they're busy doing is telling us what the administration is saying, which is siding with the opposition forces and doing more than that. Then suddenly, February 28th, late at night, February 29th, Aristide says that the number two man in the U.S. embassy goes to the home of the Aristides and says that if they don't leave, they will be killed. Thousands of Haitians may die as well. And Aristide says he wants to speak to the press. He says he was told that the U.S. was taking him to the press. Instead, they put him on a plane with dozens of U.S. security and U.S. soldiers in full combat gear, not just fatigues. They get on a plane. They're told they can't even lift the shades on their windows. They have no idea where they're going. This is a 55-seat plane. All of these soldiers and security are on with the Aristides, and they just keep flying and flying and flying until they end up in the Central African Republic, whose dictator rose to power a year before in a coup. And they are dumped there. Meanwhile, the U.S. government is putting out the line that Aristide left the country, that he resigned, that this was his doing, and this was his free choice. He finally gets a phone. He calls his friends. This is Aristide. We break the story on Democracy Now! He says that it was a modern kidnapping in a U.S.-backed coup. We saw this happen 10 years ago. There's nothing new here. It's an old M.O., and it is just important that the media, at least, whatever side they take, present all the sides. And so from our story, where we are documenting this unfold on this Monday morning of early March, the transcripts are being taken by reporters to the White House and to the Pentagon, to the briefings, to say, what has happened? Have you kidnapped the president of Haiti? Was this a U.S.-backed coup? The reporter at the Pentagon says Pacifica Radio is reporting this, and Rumsfeld just starts to laugh. And the reporters actually said, we're not asking for a chuckle or a laugh. We're asking for an answer. Because for the first time, they have something that is other than what the administration is saying. Now, they have far more resources. Why did they simply mouth the line of the administration until this point and then continue to give the line of that administration? So we end up with this exclusive report. The administration is only pushed so far. And then a group of individuals here in this country, led by U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters, takes foreign policy into her own hands. They charter a plane and they say, if he is not a prisoner there, we will go pick him up and return him to the Caribbean. And so this group and I went on this plane to document this flight from Miami to St. Thomas, to Dakar, Senegal, to Bangui, Central African Republic. And they, along with Randall Robinson of TransAfrica and a member of the Jamaican Parliament.
How long ago was that, Amy?
This was on the weekend of March 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th.
Okay.
This remarkable flight of 48 hours, where, by the way, we were also reporting exclusively, AP was taking our reports and changing the entire tenor of the coverage for the world, because for the first time we were hearing from the players themselves, from the people involved who had been ousted. Aristide's voice had hardly been heard. And there was high-stakes negotiation with the dictator over 7 hours. And around 3 o'clock in the morning, the whole delegation, including the Aristides, got on the plane. And they returned through Senegal, Cape Verde, Barbados, to Jamaica, where the Jamaican prime minister had invited the Aristides to stay, and were dropped off and came back here. It was a remarkable 48-hour journey that changed the perception in the world of what had actually taken place. But the U.S. media has hardly raised this issue at all. And as Condoleezza Rice has been getting so much attention for refusing to testify, or the administration not allowing her to testify under oath before the 9/11 Commission until she did on Thursday. In fact, behind the scenes, she was spending a lot of time putting pressure on the Jamaican prime minister, who's also the head of CARICOM, to once again expel Aristide from the hemisphere. This is a coup that's hardly gotten any notice, and that has been done in all of our names.
My name is Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters, coming to you on WILL AM 580 in Urbana, Illinois. My guest today on Easter Sunday is Amy Goodman, the internationally acclaimed journalist and the host of Pacifica Network's Democracy Now!, which is aired on over 200 radio and television stations across the U.S. and the world, and is heard here in the Urbana-Champaign area on our local community station, WEFT, 4 to 5 daily. And Amy Goodman will be in Urbana a week from Friday on April 23rd, where she will be doing a benefit for the Illinois Disciples for WEFT at the Illinois Disciples Foundation at 6:15 on April 23rd, and she'll be appearing on Media Geek, Paul Rismandel's show on WEFT, at 5:30 on Friday, April 23rd. And then last, Amy Goodman is the co-author of a new book, The Exception to the Rulers, which has just come out, co-authored with her brother, David Goodman, also a journalist, and we're talking about the book today, in which she presents her analysis of politics and the media system in the United States today and the world. And let me just, before we get back to Amy, leave you with this quote from Michael Moore concerning Amy Goodman. As Moore writes, quote, "She gets up every morning of every day, long before the rest of us, to be the only daily voice of truth on the radio in the United States of America. How sad that I even have to write those words. A nation of 300 million, a written guarantee of a free press, and no one will do the job that Amy Goodman does so simply, so profoundly." Michael Moore writing about Amy Goodman. And we're talking now so far on the show about the mainstream press, or the corporate press, its coverage of crucial issues, the build-up to the war in Iraq, the coup against the Aristide government, the elected Aristide government in Haiti just 6 weeks ago. And we're going to be talking more about The Exception to the Rulers with Amy Goodman this hour. Let me remind you that this is a pre-tape show. I guess that's a tape show. We did a couple of days before going on the air on Easter Sunday with Amy, so please don't call in today. Just sit back and listen. Concerning the Iraq War, too, getting back to your point of departure, Amy, as you said, there was almost no critical commentary of the Powell speech then. But at the same time, as you know, later that year, editor and publisher actually fact-checked Powell's UN speech and found it chock full of error. And so it was sort of like a post-mortem, but it was then 7 or 8 months after the fact.
That's right. And I think it's interesting you say editor and publisher. I mean, how many people in this country read that? It's you know, for the trade. It's for journalists. It's for editors and publishers. And unfortunately, what they know and what they report are often two very different things, meaning the editors and publishers of different papers. I mean, I really think, Bob, that the media has reached an all-time low in this country. I mean, when you look at the coverage of the events leading up to the invasion, and then you look at right through to now, in the horrific time we are in right now in this occupation, with well over now 600 soldiers who have died in Iraq, not to mention the thousands of Iraqis who have died that we supposedly went to save. I mean, right now you have this small group of pundits that we have watched for a year on television, a very small circle that are on both the corporate networks and on PBS. They just seem to rotate through the networks. I begin to wonder if there's one main network and they just, the logos of the different stations, you know, they sort of rotate through the hours. A year ago, they got it wrong. Then it was chanting weapons of mass destruction. Now, we know the administration lied. They got it wrong. But the media is not supposed to be a conveyor belt for those lies. They got it wrong a year ago. And now a year later, when it is accepted that they did not find the weapons of mass destruction, you have that same group of know-nothing pundits who know so little about so much, who are wringing their hands on all of these networks and are saying, how did we get it so wrong? Well, why not invite one of those people who did not get it so wrong, either then or now, who were raising questions about the credibility of the analysis and the intelligence? And this goes right to the paper of record, to the New York Times, to people like Judith Miller, who had the one front page story after another, citing unnamed sources, either in the administration or the Iraqi National Congress. You often didn't even know that's where they were from, who had their own agenda. And there they go. And again, and continually beat the drums for war so that people are so afraid they'll do anything to protect themselves.
Well, now it seems, Amy, that the two major claims for war, which were weapons of mass destruction and Saddam Hussein's links to the Al-Qaeda terror network, that were the most heavily promoted ones prior to the war, have been more or less totally discredited. Now the new claim seems to be that, well, Saddam Hussein was such a lousy guy and a terrible person and such a reprehensible figure that whatever the reasons we give, going in there and getting rid of him is going to be, on balance, good for Iraqis. And if one cares about human rights and democracy, regardless of the reasons given a year ago, we ought to be delighted to get rid of this guy.
And well, Bob. Go ahead.
No, well, yeah. How do you respond? And this seems to be
There is no question. Oh, there is no question that that guy was a thug and a dictator. How did he stay in power for so many decades? He was shored up by the U.S. government. This is a man who was armed by the U.S. government. Yeah, he was frightening. And if, though, it was enough to say that this is a military dictator we want to take out, then the Bush administration would have just said that. But they did their polls and their analysis, and they found that the American people and the senators and congressmen did not feel that it was enough to say he was a threat to his own people and that they had to say he was an imminent threat to us in the United States. And so they didn't use that argument then. Let's remember that Congress rubber-stamped this, that approved it, and it was based on the fact that this dictator was a threat to us in the United States. That was the rationale that was used. But I also wanted to point out something else that I just recently learned, that I can't think of a better illustration for the way the media works, and something that you, Bob, in your new book and all of your work illustrate so well, and that is this relationship between the media and those in power, and serving those in power and not serving the rest of us. Former White House aide to take post at NBC, Ana Perez, who recently directed communications at the National Security Council, will become chief communications executive for NBC, the network has just announced. Ms. Perez will take up the post of executive vice president for communications, but her duties will expand when NBC becomes NBC Universal after the expected completion of the network's merger with entertainment units of Vivendi Universal. The deal is expected to be approved by June. Perez will start at NBC on May 1st. Ana Perez left the White House in December, where her titles included Counselor for Communications to President Bush's National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice. Perez also worked in the White House for the first President Bush as Barbara Bush's press secretary. In the mid-80s, she was head of Creative Artists Agency and is now... she says, the quotes her, this is from the New York Times, "I love the television business. I have no expertise in it, so I will have a bit of learning curve, but I can't remember the last time I didn't have a learning curve when I took a new job." The revolving door from communications director for the National Security Council, a counselor for communications to Condoleezza Rice, is now becoming vice president for communications for NBC. Now, that is quite astounding, but it shouldn't be, because let's also look at who has become, for example, one of the chief correspondents at NBC. One of the men in charge of the press censorship rules in the Persian Gulf War, Pete Williams, he was the spokesperson for the Pentagon. He then moves over to become a chief correspondent for NBC. Well, was it any surprise? NBC owned by General Electric, which was maker of many of the parts during the Persian Gulf War, one of the chief nuclear weapons manufacturers. So you have the chief correspondent, former spokesperson for the Pentagon. You really have to ask the question, if we had state media in this country, how would it be any different?
Indeed, we do. And in fact, one of the really exciting parts or interesting parts of the new book you've just written, Amy Goodman, The Exception to the Rulers, which you've co-authored with your brother, David Goodman, also a journalist, deals with the exchanges you have that you provide transcripts for in the book with journalists like CNN's Aaron Brown and with PBS's Charlie Rose, where really, you challenge their conventional notion of journalism and how they're covering stories. And there seems to be like a real split, obviously a real split, but, you know, there's a notion that they have that they're doing neutral, objective, nonpartisan journalism, and what you're doing is sort of ideologically loaded and partisan and less committed to the truth. How do you respond? I mean, when you're given that criticism that what you're doing is, you know, less committed to being fair and accurate than what they're doing?
Well, I always say when someone says you're engaged in advocacy journalism, the corporate reporters are my model. I mean, have you ever seen more cheerleading for one point of view, especially now? And this is around the most important issues of our day, war and peace, life and death, cheerleaders for war. I was quite surprised, actually, when I went on Charlie Rose. It was the morning a Washington Post profile came out. The reporter had come to Democracy Now! Studios, and they did a piece called Peace Correspondent. And it was a very positive piece. And the Charlie Rose show called me up and asked, would I come over, you know, within an hour? And they'd like to do an interview, and they were going to run it in the next few days. So I went over. And the first question that Charlie Rose asked me is, he said, where do you broadcast? This was, you know, the beginning of the interview. And I said, oh, we broadcast on over 200 Pacifica and NPR radio stations, community stations, university stations, as well as public access TV stations, PBS, and video and audio stream at democracynow.org and on satellite television Dish Network, and which is channel 9415 Free Speech TV 4 times a day. And just as I'm saying it now, I'm smiling too because it sounded like an ad.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, this is not the way it works on the Charlie Rose show. But he asked. That's how he opened it. So mm-hmm. I said, this is all to say that we are engaged in the largest public media collaboration in this country, and we need independent media. And I didn't think that was very controversial. It was more just saying where we broadcast and the idea that we need. And he took great umbrage, offense, really, and said, what is that supposed to mean? As if the rest, he said, isn't independent.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went on to say that these were his friends. He specifically said, Dan Rather, Tom Brokaw, Peter Jennings, what are you trying to say about them? They are my friends. He said, the argument I have with respect is Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, and Dan Rather, a whole range of people are journalists who've paid their dues. They are very competent journalists who are reporting for news magazines and those broadcasts. I said, it's not just about one person. And he said, you are suggesting that because they choose the people. I said, let me quote Dan Rather himself on BBC. He says he thinks he would be necklace. He thinks he cannot simply speak out and ask the kinds of hard questions that need to be asked. I'm quoting Dan Rather. And he went on to say he doubted he would say that he was surprised he would say something like that because he is his colleagues. He said, in fact, he didn't believe he said that because they are independent. And I said, well, you don't have to take it from me. Take it from him. It was a very uncharacteristic for Charlie Rose. It made me realize afterwards how few times he has someone on he disagrees with. because people were shocked at how confrontational he was. In fact, his website got hit extremely hard with all of his viewers, not our viewers and listeners, saying that he should apologize. And very interestingly, many of them sending the BBC transcript of Dan Rather saying that he thought he would be necklaced if he raised hard questions in this country. And I think a lot of people know that there is something terribly wrong. Now that the weapons of mass destruction haven't been found, people are saying, wait a second, how did the media get it so wrong? And what is the role of the media? To quote the title of John Stauber and Sheldon Rampton's book, is it really becoming a weapon of mass deception? These are the questions we have to ask, and this is why we need an independent media in this country.
You know, in that exchange with Charlie Rose, there was an interesting passage, because he made the rejoinder, as you made the critique that I hear all the time, and I know you hear all the time, where Charlie Rose says, well, look, no owner goes in and tells Dan Rather what to report. He's not a stooge for some corporate boss. He's an independent person. He's making his own call. How do you respond to that criticism or that comment?
Censorship is not as simple as, though occasionally it happens, is not as simple as an editor or a publisher saying, you will not tell this side of the story. It's much more subtle, and it involves self-censorship. It involves reporters in a newsroom knowing at a news meeting when they're suggesting stories, what's going to get them marginalized and what's going to help them rise in the corporate media ladder. And if you are there and you are pushing to cover the peace movement as others and others look at you, the what movement, and you realize what's going to get you ahead and what isn't. You know that when you take on a tough story like who's profiting from war in Iraq or the relationship between those in the government and those in the corporations that are really making a killing in Iraq, that your editor or publisher could well get a call from someone very high up in government, and you're going to hear about it. Now, if you were to cover, and I'm saying cover critically, for example, the peace movement, you don't have to worry as much that some grassroots activist will actually even get a chance to speak to a publisher and editor, that person would even take their call. You're not going to be called on the carpet in the same way. And I think it's very important to raise these questions and to continually critique the media, because it gives people space inside, the more pressure they're getting from the outside, for those brave ones inside who want to do the work that they believe that they went into the newspaper or the TV or radio business for. And it's not a business. It's a mission. There's a reason why journalism is the only profession that is protected by the U.S. Constitution, because we are a check and balance in those in power. We are an essential part of the functioning of a democratic society, and we no longer serve as that check and balance. When we merge with the government, when we act as state media, that endangers a democratic society. Not to mention doing a disservice to the servicemen and women of this country who can't raise questions on military bases, but rely on us in civil society to raise the most important issues of our day.
We're talking to Amy Goodman today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show just a few days before we went on air, today, of course, being Easter Sunday. So don't call in to raise questions. Just sit back and let Amy and me do the talking. Amy Goodman is the internationally acclaimed journalist and the host of Pacifica Network's Democracy Now!, which is aired on over 200 radio and TV stations. If you like what you've been listening to, you can tune in to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! On locally on WEFT 4 to 5 every day. You can hear it. She's also the author of a new book that we're talking about, The Exception to the Rulers, just come out, that she wrote with her brother David Goodman, available at fine bookstores I trust everywhere and online. And we've been talking about Charlie Rose. We've been talking about mainstream journalism, its compliance, its subservience to state interests, especially in military affairs and foreign affairs and on big issues like that. You've said, Amy, that you think our journalism now is at an all-time low. It seems like we're in some sort of limbo dance to see just exactly where we're going to end up. Yet at the same time, what's striking is if you look at the bestseller list over the last 2 years, at least three of the top three or four selling books at one time or another in the past couple of years have been books purporting that our news media are rabidly liberal, even left-wing, and are hostile to business, hostile to the military, and hostile to George W. Bush. What's going on with that?
Well, I think that's a really interesting point. It is about the silenced majority. You have one book after another that has come out that is highly critical, and they are being devoured around the country and around the world. People are hungry for independent information. People are highly skeptical about what's going on, and yet the corporate media just continues. Some might be saying right now, wait a second, there's a lot of criticism right now in the media of President Bush, for example, and the Bush administration. And by the way, I'll include the Democrats in this too. But it is an election year, and that's why we're seeing the spectrum of debate open up a crack. Let's not forget what it looked like a year ago. At a time when the Democrats and Republicans agreed, when they together voted for war, there was no opening in the media. Right. We just looked at the FAIR study, three of 393 interviews done around war and the four major nightly newscasts.
Yeah.
Three of anti-war representatives. When the Democrats and Republicans agree, the media totally closes ranks. Now you have an election year. Some issues are being raised. The Democrats want to distinguish themselves from the Republicans. You'd hardly know that John Kerry actually voted to authorize the war, as did Edwards and others. And so the media reflects that debate. But so often they are agreeing, and the media has to go further than that because they both represent the power elite in this country, the Democrats and Republicans. The media is supposed to be there for all of us.
You know, Amy,
I think that this just shows people want something else.
No, I think you're referring to these books like Michael Moore's and Molly Ivins and Joe Connison's, which have been quite critical, Al Franken's as well.
Oh, you're talking about the others.
I'm talking about the Ann Coulter and Sean Hannity and John Stossel and Bernard Goldberg, books that basically say their vision of Charlie Rose and Dan Rather is that those people are like you. That this is a hostile media to conservatives, to the government, to the military.
Well,
you know, it has this left-wing bias.
Right. No, that's a good point. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. No. We've got you're right. We've got these two different sets of bestsellers.
Yeah.
And maybe that's interesting in itself.
It is. I think,
you've got this whole list of books that are highly critical. And they're getting on the top of the bestseller list. But then you're right. You've got this whole other list that is also being bought by millions of people. But that also reflects who's dominating the media. Their books get out there because they're on television so much. They are touted so much. I find it much more interesting the other because they're so excluded and yet people somehow find their books.
Yeah.
It doesn't surprise me that all these other guys, you know, who have their TV shows that are watched so much that dominate Fox, and if they're not the anchors of their shows, they are often guests on those shows, that this is the information that's getting out to people. We have a media that is there to sell product, and they are selling them. And that's why so many people are reading their stuff. Yes, they make the allegation that there is a liberal media, and they're just dead wrong. We just have to analyze who is on television, who are the guests. The FAIR study shows it right there.
We're talking to Amy Goodman today on Media Matters. Once again, just sit back and listen. We taped this a couple days before Easter, so you can't do phone calls today. Let us do the talking. Amy, your show is carried on the flagship network of Pacifica, which is five stations around the country. And then you've got another couple hundred stations, radio and television, that also air Democracy Now!, including WEFT here in Urbana-Champaign every day from 4 to 5. What about Pacifica? I think a lot of our listeners may have heard the name. You've referred to it already. You write about it in the book. What is it about Pacifica that is different from CBS or NBC or PBS, for that matter, and NPR?
Well, It's interesting. In just a few days, we begin the Exception to the Media book and media launch. We're going to be traveling to more than 70 cities around the country. Bob, I'm really excited to be with you in St. Louis on the 22nd and the 23rd at a media conference, and to celebrate also the release of your new book. And here in Champaign-Urbana, really excited to be there on the 23rd at night, and to celebrate WEFT Community Radio, which is a Pacifica affiliate. The point of this tour is to shore up community media, and Pacifica Radio is at the heart of that. It started it. On April 15th, I'll be in Berkeley, California, for the 55th anniversary of the founding of Pacifica Radio. At 3 o'clock on April 15th, 1949, a man named Lou Hill went on the air and welcomed people to the airwaves of KPFA. He had been a war resister. When he came out of the detention camps after World War II, he said there has to be a media outlet run not by corporations that profit from war, run not by corporations, as George Gerbner says, that have everything to sell and nothing to tell, that are raising our children today, but run by journalists and artists. That's how Pacifica was born. KPFA was the first station in Berkeley. It grew to 5. KPFK in Los Angeles, WPFW in Washington, WBAI, where I come from in New York, KPFT in Houston. When KPFT first went on the air in 1970, it was the only radio station in the country whose transmitter was blown up. In fact, it was blown up twice by the Ku Klux Klan. And the Exalted Cyclops or the Grand Dragon, I can't remember what their title is, said it was his proudest act. And I think that's because they understood how dangerous Pacifica is, providing a forum for people to speak for themselves, to speak from their own experience, which makes it harder to caricature or stereotype someone, which fuel these hate groups. That is how Pacifica was born. And now you have stations around the country. Pacifica pioneered in the early 50s listener sponsorship, the idea that you open the airwaves, you don't turn to corporations. You just say, if you like what you hear, can you give us money? When KPFA first went on the air in 1949, they had to actually give out FM radios because FM was in its infancy at the time, and then say, tune in. And then they were asking them for money. But that was a model, listener support, that was then adopted by NPR and also viewer support by PBS. Now, they went the corporate route to a certain extent. They take corporate underwriting, but Pacifica always remained free of that to this day, relies almost entirely on listener sponsorship and the goodwill of people who deeply believe we need a media in this country that is not beholden to corporations, but beholden to the people, to the listeners, that is done by the communities for the communities. And that's how Pacifica was founded, and that's where it is today.
In the late 1990s and into this decade, there were heavily publicized fights over who was going to run Pacifica Network between various factions. Where does that stand today? What is the status of the management of Pacifica?
Well, we're very excited to say that Pacifica has gone through a democratization process. There was an attempted coup against Pacifica, a takeover of it, and it does not surprise me in this day and age of media consolidation that you have documented so well, Bob, and I'm sure you don't get a chance to talk enough on your radio show about your own work, and it's so important. But dealing with the media moguls and their devouring community radio and television, whether commercial or nonprofit, it is not a surprise when a nonprofit, corporate-free radio network like Pacifica comes under tremendous pressure, and that's what happened in the late 1990s. There were a number of lawsuits by listeners and board members, local advisory boards, and finally, the result was major shutdowns of KPFA in Berkeley and my station WBAI in New York, attempted takeovers of the National Board of Pacifica, but ultimately the settlement was that the people would get to decide the leadership of their own network. And so in the last few months, all of the five stations have had elections for their local station boards. They're called LSBs. And from there, those LSBs decided who would be on the national board. They had their first meeting just a few weeks ago. In fact, it was the weekend that I was flying to the Central African Republic. And just to correct the date, it was March 13th, 14th, and 15th. Mm-hmm. Covering the bringing back of Aristide to the Caribbean. And there was the Pacifica board and supporters of Pacifica meeting in Berkeley, California, to install the new board. And we'll see what happens from here. But that is the state of Pacifica today.
So, much more optimistic picture than it was a few years ago.
Much more. Very much in the control of the different communities that deeply believe in independent media. It is the only non-corporate independent media network broadcasting in this country. And I am extremely proud to be a part of it, and thankful to the millions of listeners who have come before and are here today. And I know there are many in the area who are listening right now who helped to protect and preserve this precious national treasure that is Pacifica Radio and all of the affiliates.
Now, in this country, public broadcasting has a different track. Public, the PBS television system that Charlie Rose appears on when he's not on CBS, and NPR, National Public Radio, which is probably the dominant radio journalism in the United States today, since commercial radio journalism has all but been terminated in the past decade. What is your take on NPR and PBS as independent voices, independent of commercial media or corporate media?
Well, I don't get a chance to listen too much to radio through the day because we're working so hard here, putting out Democracy Now! Every day with an amazing team of people. This daily grassroots, independent, unembedded international news hour. But I am concerned when NPR follows the agenda set by the corporate press. Now, I say this even as Democracy Now! Is broadcasting on dozens of NPR stations around the country, and we're very proud to be doing that. We think it's a very important complement to the programming there. More and more stations are picking us up just as we provide a forum for grassroots voices around the world. And I do think that NPR programming needs to do more of that. There is a tremendous hunger out there, and there are movements and people all over the country that are working to put us on their stations, and many are successful, and the stations end up being very successful as a result, because the show raises as much money or more, as all things considered, in Morning Edition for each individual station. And I think that attests to people wanting something different. You know, I go back to the example, Bob, of the coverage of the early protests of the invasion of Iraq. We were in Washington, Pacifica, broadcasting the first major protest. I think it was in October. And C-SPAN was there also. And there were near 200,000 people out there. And yet, NPR and the New York Times said there were very few people out there. The New York Times said there were a few thousand people out, despite the fact the sun had come up. That was to just add a little, to make it even worse for
twist
them.
Twist the knife a little bit.
What did they? That's right. And yet, look at, I mean, I was talking to the police there. They were giving me these numbers that they don't do an official count. And you could just hear it. You could see it. I thought it was very interesting that someone was out there at the protest expecting that that the New York Times would underestimate. And they were handing out New York Times's number saying, call and tell them you're here. Maybe they'll come out. And it turned out that the reporter was not there at the height of the protest or through the protest. She called someone on the cell phone to get a comment from them. And the other quotes were from people a few days before, because she had been put on another story, not her own fault, but the fault of a media of the New York Times that decides where to allocate its resources. They were putting her on another story rather than on this extremely important story in this country around the world of the growing peace movement. NPR had a reporter who said there are less than 10,000 people out. There were more than close to 200,000, more than 100,000 people. Now, because of the response, people, what are you talking about? When that came out, The next day, they had to post an apology on their website, and by the middle of the week, they were apologizing on the air. But it is an environment that allows that kind of misrepresentation to happen, an environment that minimizes the protest, the voice of those not in power, the voice of those who are not the establishment. Now, over this year, the cracks in the establishment have started to emerge. And you have very high-level people like Richard Clark, who was in the Bush and Clinton administrations as the top, you know, terrorism advisor, anti-terrorism advisor. When they start to speak out, we start to hear their voices. But it should not just be those in power. It should be all of those who are very active in civil society at whatever level that the media is paying attention to, not just those who have press secretaries and press offices and PR people that can have easy access to the reporters and to the editors.
We're talking to Amy Goodman today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you on WILL AM 580 on Easter Sunday. Thank you for joining us. Amy Goodman, the host of Democracy Now!, heard locally on WEFT from 4 to 5 every day, and the co-author of the new book, The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Loved Them. Amy, you know, let's talk about 9/11 because that is the big story. And I think that oftentimes, as you just referred to Richard Clark, now I'll hear people say, well, you know, the media is doing a good job of sort of really getting after the Bush administration on the months leading up to 9/11, how well prepared they were to do battle with al-Qaeda. What's your take on the press coverage of the 9/11 commission and on the quality of that commission? And what stories are they missing that ought to be getting more attention than are getting attention currently in the news media?
Just the deals that are made, what is going to happen with this report, the fact that we continually refer to it as independent, but President Bush was so involved in choosing the people, the story. You know, this is coming from a lot of reporters from mainstream publications. But what matters, first of all, is most people get their information from television. And what matters is the drumbeat coverage. What are the voices you hear on a regular basis? This week we had on Seymour Hersh, a very important piece he came out with this week in the New Yorker magazine about the other war, and that is the war in Afghanistan that he says is basically being lost. The subtitle, Why Bush's Afghanistan Problem Won't Go Away. The story of how the going into Afghanistan and then the diversion to Iraq, what this meant. I mean, the media, those in power, those in the administration continually say, we were not wrong to look at all possibilities. To ask if the September 11th attacks were in any way related to Saddam Hussein is not irresponsible. We want to cover all of our bases. And I think that that has a ring for people. Of course, you want to be responsible. You want to be comprehensive. But when you look at, after the invasion of Afghanistan and talking about al-Qaeda and how to go after it, the diversion of resources, there are so many in the last year, people within the intelligence community, within the military community, who are given so little credence through this year, especially by people like Judith Miller of the New York Times, who were saying that this is not about being comprehensive and covering all bases. There is no evidence of this. And if we take our forces away from Afghanistan, we will lose there and we will attack a country that, in fact, was not involved with this. But most importantly, we will increase our insecurity. We will threaten the national security of this country. And that's exactly what has happened. The 9/11 Commission is very important. Deals were made even now with this testimony of Condoleezza Rice. First, it shows the power of the media when they start to be critical. I want to start there. Why is Condoleezza Rice testifying before the 9/11 Commission? Because every once in a while, the media does get on a bandwagon. And when they focus their attention on issues that matter, you see the effect. Bush was forced to back down. What I kept emphasizing during the time she was saying no, she wasn't going to testify in public, wasn't going to testify under oath. I mean, that is astounding. Here she was going on television, certainly was in the public view. And of course, she's doing the administration's bidding. It's not that she is refusing. Let's be clear. It's the Bush administration is not allowing her until they did. She was refusing to testify, I would always say in Democracy Now, under oath. I mean, that was the point that was being missed, not about what her role is. And we were the first, among the first, certainly in broadcast, to say when they kept repeating no national sitting national security advisor testified, it wasn't true. Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Clinton's national security advisor, Sandy Berger, they'd all testified. And yet the media continued. They never do their homework. I should never say never. They rarely do their homework. History seems to be missing from the networks, and it is so important. It's something that Pacifica does best, is to continually go back into the archives and to give us historical context. But it simply wasn't true. And in addition, saying that she wouldn't testify under oath. And now you have Bush also finally agreeing that he will testify, not just to two commissioners, but to all of them. Okay, he's not doing it under oath, and he's only doing it with Dick Cheney at his side, which is also very interesting. Yeah, and questions should be raised about that.
That seems extraordinarily interesting that he will only do this if the vice president is there with him at the exact same time to sort of vet, for what reasons are unclear, but it can only sort of lead to ruminations about what's going on. What's your sense with that? Oh, we're talking to Amy Goodman today on Media Matters. She'll be joining us in a second. While we take a break,
just one sec.
That's all right, Amy. Yeah. Before we get back to Amy, let me remind you that 1 week from today, we're going to have John Nichols as our guest on Media Matters, the political columnist for The Nation magazine. And 2 weeks from today, our guest will be Janine Garofalo, the radio host now, actress and comedian. So please stay tuned to Media Matters. And if you'd like to get our weekly email with updates on our guests like Amy Goodman today and with links to their books and their shows, you can get a weekly email from our producer, Victor Picard. Just email Victor at vpicard@uiuc.edu, and Victor will put you on our weekly email list, and you can get off it with one click. It won't be used for any commercial purposes. You'll only get one email. We've got several hundred people who currently receive it, and I think they like it because it means if you are interested in what you're listening to on Media Matters, you don't have to take a notepad to get a name or anything or to get a URL so you can find out about the guest. You can simply get the email and go click directly from there. So again, if you're interested in doing that, go to vpicard@uiuc.edu, and Victor will sign you up and get you onto our weekly list. Are you there now, Amy Goodman?
Sorry, Bob. Even though I'm coughing, I just want to remind people, independent media is nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And in fact, we're almost winding out. That's quite all right. We're almost winding out of time today. We've only got about a minute or a minute and a half left. And I think on that note, Amy, you conclude the book with a chapter called Free the Media. I mean, clearly this is a crucial theme in your new book, The Exception to the Rulers. How do we free the media? What are some ideas you've got?
Well, I think a lot is happening around this country and around the world. we have the model of Pacifica Radio. We have the model of independent media centers around the country and around the world. We saw the power of these IMCs, indiemedia.org, first really fully blossom in Seattle with the protests against the World Trade Organization. At the same time, you had 50,000 people marching in the streets representing a cross-section of people in this country and around the world concerned about...
Regrettably, on that note, yes. My producer is playing the tunes, which means I've got to get out of the studio. I apologize for that. I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Our guest has been Amy Goodman, author of The Exception to the Rulers. Thank you for listening to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob.
Partly sunny skies today, high in the mid-50s, north winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy, low in the lower 30s, northeast winds around 15 miles per hour. Partly sunny tomorrow, high in the lower 50s, northeast winds around 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, with a chance of light rain in the evening, turning into a mix of rain and snow after midnight. Low in the mid-30s, north winds around 15 miles per hour. This is WILL, Urbana.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Boneyard Arts Festival, an annual event celebrating and showcasing Champaign County's visual and performing arts community, April 16th and 17th, in various venues throughout Champaign-Urbana, the U of I campus, Savoy, and Mahomet. More information on the web at 40north.org.